You're listening to KHENLPFM Radio 106.9 Salida. Excuse me for a little technical difficulties there. And we're streamed on the internet at khen.org. And this is Truth Quest. And tonight I have my co-host back. It's been a while, as Dr. Eric Carlstrom, my other co-host. And if you'd like to listen to tonight's program or any past programs of Truth Quest with Melody, they're available at www.givemesometruth.info or linked from the khen.org website. And if you'd like to send an email into the program for questions with our guest, our email address is khen.dj@gmail.com. And the views expressed on this program are those of myself and or my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the KHEN staff, volunteers, or board of directors. And one other thing, but I guess I'll wait. Okay, I've got Professor Carlstrom and Ralph Schoenman with me. Are you both there?
Yes, I'm here.
Yes.
Okay, great, great. Eric, would you like to go ahead and introduce Ralph? Or
I'd like to get it started. I first heard Ralph speak in the context of the International Citizens Inquiry to 911. There were two conferences that were held in May of 2004. The first one, I think, in Toronto, and the second one in San Francisco, or it may have been the other way around. But anyway, there were two conferences that he spoke at, and in one of the talks, he's got a long history of involvement with issues like this. I think he was part of an international inquiry into the war in Vietnam and the Southeast Asian wars. Were you not, Ralph?
I was Secretary General of the International Tribunal on U.S. War Crimes in Indochina, yes.
Yeah, and so when the confusion that followed 2001, people were trying to scramble to figure out what was going on. Ralph was in a position, as some others were also, to shed some light because he has such a knowledge of related events. And so in these two talks, I've actually got his DVDs here, and I'll tell you where you can order them. In one of the talks he gives, it's called The Underlying Politics of 911. That's from the Toronto talk, May 27, 2004. And then in another DVD, he's talking about 911 false flag operation. That's March 26th through 28th at the San Francisco inquiry. Ralph, I know that we might want to try to get into some of the modern financial
issues. Well, sure.
But could we start with the 911 issue, and could you kind of in brief summarize some of the main points that you hit back in those days, and then bring us up to date as to where the whole 911 truth movement is and what hope we have for getting some justice?
Well, let me mention, by the way, that my wife and I, Maya Schoen, have a national radio program called Taking Aim, which is heard actually as well in 77 countries. We broadcast on the Pacifica Radio Network, and notably in New York City on WBAI, and also on something called the Progressive Radio Network, which broadcasts the program nationally on Wednesdays at 11 a.m. and 11 p.m. 9/11 is actually nothing particularly new in the history of the way in which our ruling class operates in the United States. Every time that the U.S. has needed a rationale for an imperial undertaking, an adventure long planned, they create a pretext of this nature, what we call a false flag operation. When the U.S. had a desire and a plan to establish its control over Cuba and the Philippines and displace the former colonial domain of Spain in what became the Spanish-American War, they blew up a ship of the United States in Havana Harbor called the Maine, and as you recall, the Hearst Press created the mantra, "Remember the Maine." And this has been the system. I mean, going back, in fact, to when James Polk was president of the United States and the U.S. had ambitions to basically amputate two-thirds of Mexico, not just Texas after all, but establishing an artificial border for that particular Mexican state, which was something like a third further south than its actual border. What James Polk did, as Abraham Lincoln, a young congressman, documented amongst many others in the U.S. House of Representatives at the time, was essentially to stage an operation in which U.S. soldiers, pretending and dressed as Mexican troops, fired on U.S. soldiers, and there was their pretext, an entirely contrived undertaking. And that has been the consistent pattern with World War I, for that matter, when the U.S. aspired to challenge the imperial domain of the European colonial powers. The Lusitania's signals were conveyed by insurance companies to the German High Command, along with the intelligence that there were actually armaments on board. And so it goes. I mean, the specifics with respect to 9/11, I think, were well understood at the time of the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center, which many of your listeners may recall, that taking place under the aegis of President Clinton. In that situation, what actually occurred was that a high-level FBI operative and Egyptian intelligence agent named Emad Ali Salem was sent by the Federal Bureau of Investigation into the mosque of the blind Egyptian cleric Sheikh Omar Abdul Rahman, his mosque in Brooklyn and his mosque in New Jersey. And there he went and attempted to engage the blind cleric, and he was saying things of this nature, that don't you think, given the fact that the Egyptian peasants are selling their kidneys for coin, that the U.S. subsidizes the Mubarak regime as it does the Israeli state, and that appropriately the victims of this should take action against the, and the Sheikh, very sensitive to a provocation of this nature, never having seen this man before, said to him that we don't discuss other than our political opposition to things of this kind, and I have no time for you. Whereupon Emad Ali Salem began to recruit youngsters from the mosque to come to meetings where he would proposition them with things like, you know, we really have to act here consistent with our sentiments and where our families are experiencing. He said, we should take out the Lincoln Tunnel and the Holland Tunnel and the George Washington Bridge and the Statue of Liberty and so on. And why, you know, most of the kids would look at him like he was crazed and leave. Some would stay out of fascination. All the time, this Emad Ali Salem is wearing a wire, and he is making transcripts from these provocations that he is himself creating, all of which are then housed in the offices of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, 50 file cabinet boxes worth for a period of 6 months. One of the interesting facets of this, I should mention, is that the person who arranged the so-called safe house and made the arrangements for the rioter rental van was a notorious Mossad Israeli intelligence operative named Guzi Haddad. And interestingly, this is all over the press, by the way. This is not something that you have to search for. There's nothing arcane about it. Because when the detonation of the World Trade Center took place in 1993, the local cops detained Emad Ali Salem. That was not in the plan. And one of the interesting things about this is that Emad Ali Salem said, you know, he said, I was assured by my superiors that the explosives we provided would not detonate. That's all over the New York Times, the LA Times, and so on. So the character, and of course within minutes of this explosion that killed and wounded hundreds of people at the time, it was immediately ascribed to whom? To terrorists, including someone named Osama bin Laden, you know, more dangerous than 50,000 hydrogen bomb-bearing missiles, more menacing than the former Soviet Union. It's Osama bin Laden from his cave in Afghanistan. A more absurd hypothesis has yet to be constructed. And the thing about the 93 bombing of the World Trade Center is that all of the elements of what then unfolded with the bombing of the World Trade Center in on September 11, 2001 are there for all with eyes to see. I had written an article about this at the time in a magazine called Prevailing Winds that who bombed the World Trade Center? Evidence points to the Federal Bureau of Investigation. So, naturally, of course, with this history, when 2001 occurred, anyone who is attentive to these events and knows this history immediately spotted all of the elements. Let me just, if I may, mention one antecedent event which is illuminating. Because, in 1962, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Lyman Limnitzer prepared a plan which was signed off on by all members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. It was called Operation Northwood. And what it anticipated was airplanes crashing into buildings, American citizens being killed or assassinated in Washington and in Miami, Florida. And it also anticipated the blowing up of the rocket carrying astronaut John Glenn, all of which was to be ascribed to Fidel Castro and the Cuban Revolution to create a casus belli, a pretext for yet another attempt to assassinate Castro and invade Cuba. Now, these documents of Operation Northwood, interestingly enough, were, of course, completely secreted and concealed. But at the time of the film by Oliver Stone, you may recall, called JFK, about the assassination or execution of John F. Kennedy, it created a firestorm of opinion about the Murder Incorporated, that is, the U.S. ruling class. And there's tremendous pressure to open up the files on the Kennedy execution. And consequently, the JFK Records Act was actually passed in response to the outpouring of opinion that arose out of the film of Oliver Stone. And in a bureaucratic mishap, Operation Northwood was included in these documents that were released. And a reporter who happened to be the co-producer of the ABC's World News Tonight with the late Peter Jennings, he uncovered these documents, and he published a book called I'm blocking on the title. It'll come to me in a moment. It's a very important book in which he laid out all of the elements that I'm describing to you of Operation Northwood. So, as I say, the events of September 11, 2001 are hardly sui generis. They're not distinctive. They're not unique. They are exactly the process through which the rulers in this society attempt to create what we call false flag operations to whipsaw people into numbed acquiescence into long-established plans. And those are the essential features of all of the elements of the destruction of the World Trade Center, the Twin Towers, and, of course, the Pentagon, and so on. The evidence is so massive and overwhelming as to the hand of the U.S. authorities and that of the Israeli Mossad in these events, one scarcely knows where to begin. Of course, the physical evidence is itself transparent. I mean, here are buildings that are obviously collapsing on their footprint in the same time that free fall would allow. Unless the laws of physics were reversed on that day, this is absolutely impossible without controlled demolition, which is very long established. Never in the history of the construction of high-rises has any high-rise building, let alone one steel reinforced, collapsed as a consequence of a hydrocarbon fire, because the temperatures reached by hydrocarbon fires are nothing remotely sufficient to compromise the integrity of steel or concrete. In this particular circumstance of the Twin Towers, the steel was reduced to molten liquid and the concrete pulverized into dust. There are many other facets. I mean, the detonations have been recorded on countless TV cameras and on sound machines of the established media of the time. There have been multiple documentaries which demonstrate visually exactly how these towers came down. The airplanes in question are quite incapable of being responsible for the collapse of these towers and their footprint. Of course, your listeners will recall that one of the buildings that so collapsed was Building 7, which wasn't even touched by an airplane. So, it's just an insult to people's intelligence. The most elementary examination of the evidence immediately translates into an understanding that this is a contrived event, and the official fiction is exactly that. We could move on, if you wish, to some of the concerns about the so-called hijackers, not one of whom was on a flight manifest of any of these airplanes. But to take the most notorious of them, Mohammed Atta, the question that we always raise is what and which Mohammed Atta? Is it the young man who his father, who was a noted lawyer in Cairo, had described as rather shy and effeminate and wholly disinterested in either politics or religion and merely interested in being an engineer and in studying engineering? Is it that Mohammed Atta? Is it the young man in Hamburg, Germany, who's being run by German intelligence and funded by something called the Duisburg Foundation with Rockefeller and Kissinger on its board, flying this fellow all over the world? Is it that Mohammed Atta? Is it the Mohammed Atta who is stationed at Brooks Air Force Base with a security clearance and whose contact address is the Pensacola Naval Station? Is it that Mohammed Atta? Is it the Mohammed Atta who's rooming with Charlie Goff, who was a contract pilot for the contra operations of the Central Intelligence Agency in Nicaragua, flying cocaine arms in and cocaine out? Is it that Mohammed Atta? Is it the Mohammed Atta who his father said spoke to him on the telephone on September 12th? And so we could go. The young Mohammed Atta, who is supposed to have hijacked the airplane at Logan Airport, actually was in Portland, Maine, and took a puddle jumper to Logan Airport, arriving something like 18 minutes before the plane to be hijacked was about to depart. And his associates drive up in an automobile, we are told, and there they wanted to put their car in a parking lot, in a parking space, except that somebody took the parking space from them. So what do? They get out of their car, and in heavily Arabic-inflected English begin to scream and curse and menace this frightened driver in this car to the point where he calls the police. Exactly what putative hijackers are going to do on the verge of hijacking an aircraft. The whole thing is such a fatuous array of classical disinformation and intelligence plants and leaks and the whole nine yards that any attempt to look at any facet of this immediately makes transparent what it is that we're dealing with. I've gone on a long time. It's a kind of synopsis, but I think it tells us what we need to know about the nature of this event.
Okay, well, I certainly agree with what you're saying, and I've come to those conclusions myself, having looked at the evidence. So where do you think we are now, Ralph, in terms of the whole process of trying to convince the American people to get a real investigation of 911, to get some kind of justice, to expose what's going on? Certainly Barack Obama and the people in power now are not interested in having this discussion, it would appear. They maintain the fiction of Osama bin Laden as boogeyman, and terrorism is something we need to worry about.
Yeah.
So how are we doing with the 911 truth movement? What's your assessment?
Well, the noted attorney William Pepper, who was the lawyer for Martin Luther King and who had written two books about the government's role in the assassination of Martin King, he and I and others are working together in preparing an actual commission of inquiry that entail a will have subpoena power. We need a certain number of signatures to get this on the ballot in New York, and once on the ballot, we actually will have, on the basis of that, it's sort of a peculiarity of the laws, we have it in California, you know, where propositions of this kind can be put forward. So there are 30,000 signatures already, and we're going to accumulate quite a bit more, and but, I mean, I have to say to you quite candidly that the bringing to justice, if you like, the perpetrators of the events of September 11th will not happen in the United States without a vast mobilization of our people for the removal of this ruling class, this structure of power, which, as the Wall Street Journal wrote recently, chronicled, consists of 1% of the population that owns more than 90% of the rest of us taken together. I mean, it was well summarized by the former president of Wall Street and American Express, Richard Townsend, who wrote a book called Up the Organization, who calculated the number of people who control the commanding heights of the U.S. economy, number approximately 5,000. They average about 14 corporate directorships per individual. As Townsend put it, they look upon the country as their private whorehouse, and they consider each president their personal towel boy. So I think if you understand how the finance and corporate capital have captured the state, how the state is essentially their instrument, it subsidizes their doings, and it is their coercive instrument for protecting their colonial domain. You know, this tiny little ruling class, this extraordinary concentration of power in our society, it's 1% owning more than 90% of the rest of us. Well, bear in mind, we only have about 5% of the world's population within our national frontiers. And yet this 1% of 5% has command over something like 2/3 of the world's natural resources. Well, by any criterion, that's an empire. And you want to sell the necessity for people to subsidize the dependence of the U.S. economy on military production? How are you going to do that? Particularly when the former Soviet Union has collapsed, the boogeyman of the time that, you know, anti-communism and the subversion of the Soviet Union and all of that ideological claptrap was the rationale for U.S. imperialism and U.S. military reach. With its absence, they required an alternative ideological fiction with which to justify and rationalize this dependence upon arms production in our society. And that is the category of terror, whereby anyone that is in any sense opposed to U.S. designs is immediately demonized as a, quote, terrorist, unquote. Fictive categories created, such as this handful of people in Afghanistan who had been mobilized and funded by the Central Intelligence Agency itself in their efforts to overthrow the former Marxist regime in Kabul and Afghanistan, and they created this whole drug-infected group of real terrorists who were subsidized by CIA. I mean, it's well described by Brzezinski in his book The Grand Chessboard. And they further utilize these people to attempt to destabilize the former Islamic republics of the prior Soviet Union, if you recall, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Turkmenistan, these republics. And that drew in, as Brzezinski described it, the Soviet Union into what he called the bear trap, into Afghanistan to attempt to address these actual armed terrorists of the Central Intelligence Agency. And the entire fiction of this Al-Qaeda, which barely existed at all, it means basically the central or the organization, I mean, it's a handful of people. They couldn't break wind without being monitored by the Central Intelligence Agency. Maya and I were in Pakistan and India for about 6 weeks last October, and November, and we were meeting with heads of the Pakistani intelligence services, the ISI, which was running this operation and being funded by CIA, who were profoundly disaffected from all this, particularly General Hamid Ghul. Hamid had, right after 9/11, he had, having been in the cockpit of these events and knowing the whole situation of so-called Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden intimately, since the CIA, we had estimated that they'd handed over, the CIA did about $6 to $8 billion to Osama bin Laden and this warlord Gulbuddin Hekmatyar. And I asked General Ghul what kind of money had the CIA put into this, and he said, well, around $8 to $10 billion. He drew himself up and he said, $50 billion, my dear sir. Ghul Hamid, interestingly enough, right after 9/11, he was interviewed by Arno de Borsgrave, who is the former editor of Newsweek and United Press International, an agency operative as it happens. And de Borsgrave called up General Ghul and to get him to give his assessment of the terrorist attacks originating in Afghanistan on the United States on September 11th. And Ghul Hamid said to him, "Are you serious?" He says, "You people trained me. This is an inside job." He says, "Anybody with eyes to see understands that this is interdicted space over the financial district of New York and over the White House and the Pentagon. I mean, you have NORAD, you have flights in the air 24 hours a day. You have nearly an hour's time difference between the planes hitting the Trade Center and the events in Washington. Are you serious?" He said, "You want to understand who did this? Look to the who benefits. It's the, your military and the intelligence services who could conceivably have gotten these vast budgets approved or accepted by the public, going into vast deficit financing after a surplus without some rationale and pretext." I mean, de Borsgrave nearly plots listening to this, and he says, "What about Osama bin Laden?" He says, "Osama bin Laden?" He said, "From his cave in Afghanistan?" Ghul Hamid said, "Please, this is designed to put people into a state that's like the Kennedy killing." Ghul Hamid, we were astonished to have this. I mean, this from Ghul Hamid, we immediately contacted him, and my and I had have done extensive one-on-one interviews with Ghul Hamid, in which he's laid out a tremendous amount of his data, as have others who had these responsibilities at the time and who were totally alienated by what the U.S. then began to attempt to do, which is not only to carve up Afghanistan, but as you now see, doing the same to Pakistan and staging the same kind of false flag events with the blowing up of the Marriott Hotel in Islamabad, and most recently, a few days ago, another such act, all with the same footprint and history of what we've been discussing and describing. I mean, quite frankly, I mean, there's so much that we could deal with respect to the nature of imperialism and the ways in which they stage such events. It's part of the history. There's Operation Gladio the CIA was running in Italy when they were attempting to destroy the partisans and the communist and socialist parties in Italy and backing the mafia and reestablishing the mafia in Sicily. And under Operation Gladio, Central Intelligence, Alan Dulles engineered all this. They staged assassinations, which they ascribed to the Red Brigades in Italy. They kidnapped the Italian Prime Minister, Aldo Moro. He was killed. They blew up the train station in Bologna. All of this now is amply documented. There have been some very important books that have gotten chapter and verse. There's no longer any ambiguity. All the CIA documents are at hand. There's nobody in Italy who isn't cognizant of this and so on. So what I'm trying to express here is that 9/11 is not a distinct or unique phenomenon. It is part of the normal, established criminal operation of this ruling class that we have, that has usurped power in the United States, has captured the state, which commands the economy, which, by the way, is imploding. It's a system in terminal decay, as everybody can now experience and see.
So is this also tied in with much of the Palestinian situation?
Well, I mean, in the sense that the Zionist state of Israel is an entire construct of U.S. imperialism. One has to understand that in the aftermath of the Second World War, the desire of subject peoples throughout the world and through Africa, Asia, and of course in the Arab East was for national independence, their self-determination, for displacing the former colonial powers, or the colonial powers, I should say, of Great Britain and France, and of course the United States having, after World War II, displaced the former colonial domain of enemy and ally alike. And one of the first things that the United States did was to take over from Great Britain the creation of a colonial settler regime in Palestine that would serve as their shock troops in the region. And I've written a great deal about this. I've written a book called The Hidden History of Zionism. My wife and I did the report for the UN on the treatment of Palestinian prisoners in three jurisdictions, which we later expanded into a book called Prisoners of Israel. Yes, of course, the Israeli state, the Zionist state, is an instrument of U.S. Imperialism in the region. Its function is to constantly engage Arab governments in conflict and in war, above all to remove the Palestinian people not only from their land, but from history. An interesting facet of this is that the representative of the Jewish Agency before the United Nations Special Committee in 1947, which was considering partitioning Palestine over the heads of the Palestinian people, the Zionist movement at that time had got control of about 2 or 3% of the land, largely through the purchase of land from absentee Turkish landlords during the time of the Ottoman Empire and so on. The UN, through Truman and Stalin jointly, Stalin attempting to appease the United States by assisting them in displacing the British and French in the region and taking over all that oil and colonial domain. Truman and Stalin, that's quite a slip, facilitated the partitioning of Palestine. They gave 55% of the most fertile land to the Zionist settlers, who immediately and without even waiting for the establishment of the state began a series of massacres from one end of Palestine to the other, from, as we say, from El Khalil, which is Hebron, to Jalil, which is Galilee. They drove out something on the order of 780,000 people out of a population of just under 900,000 at the time. They now had in their possession 475 Palestinian towns and villages. They proceeded to reduce them to rubble. 385 of the Palestinian towns and villages were wiped off the map. The remaining 90 had their land confiscated. And the populations who had been massacred, their surviving people who fled as refugees, now in desperate camps spread across the Arab East, in Lebanon, in Jordan, in Egypt, in Syria, and in what was then part of Jordan in the West Bank, constantly subject to the same predation, constant assault and massacre across the entire length and breadth of suffering Palestine, all of this entirely subsidized by U.S. imperialism, something in the order now of $4 billion a year. That's the official figure. It doesn't include all the loans that never get paid back or have to be paid back. It doesn't include the putting of vast sums from U.S. states like the state of California into Israeli-controlled banks at a fraction of the normal interest rate, which is a form of subsidy, and so on. So, yeah, the Israeli state is the extension of U.S. imperial power in the region. It is its instrument. It is a murderous instrument. This is a subject very close to my and myself. I'm just going to read you a couple of quotations, brief ones, which I think capture what we're addressing here. Because every major spokesperson for the Zionist movement, from its nominal right to its nominal left, have articulated the same agenda. Joseph Weitz in 1940, who was the head of the Zionist colonization program for David Ben-Gurion, the labor Zionist, said, "Between us, there's no room for the Palestinian people in this land. Not one clan, not one village, not one tribe shall be left." And to capture the way in which this process of displacing and removing the Palestinian population unfolded, I just quote from the publication called Davar, regarding what we call the massacre or the slaughter in the town of Duema in 1948. Davar was the official Hebrew daily newspaper of the labor Zionist Histadrut, General Federation of Workers. Quote, "They killed between 80 to 100 Palestinian men, women, and children. To kill the children, the soldiers fractured their heads with sticks. There was not one home without corpses. The men and women of the villages were pushed into houses without food or water. Then the soldiers came to dynamite them. Commanders ordered soldiers to bring women into the building they were about to blow up. Soldiers prided themselves on raping Palestinian women before shooting them to death. One Arab woman with her newborn baby was made to clean the place for a couple of days, then they shot her and the baby. Educated and well-mannered commanders, who were considered good guys, became base murderers, and this not in the storm of battle, but as a method of expulsion and extermination. The fewer the Arabs who remain, the better." Unquote. Now, you can replicate that horrendous description of what occurred at Duema multiple times. It's unfolding as we speak in Gaza. This is the character of the Zionist state. It's why the leading Jewish theologian in Israel, Yeshua Leibovitz, characterized the Zionists as Judeo-Nazis. And it has been an indispensable instrument of every American administration, and of course every political figure has fallen over themselves in the United States, singing the praises of the Zionist state and calling for its total subsidy and for U.S. Military force to be there at its disposal.
Well, you know, this is while we're on this subject, I recall from the talk that you have on this DVD, you talk about the role of Benjamin Netanyahu in the construction of, well, of course, we can go back to Begin and the others of the Stern Gang when we talk about the very early Zionist terrorists. But Netanyahu, of course, is now the prime minister of Israel.
Yes, that's correct.
Could you give us a little insight into his background and how that all might tie into 9-1-1?
Well, it's rather interesting about Netanyahu because, you see, actually he was exposed in the Israeli press of having four different Social Security cards and identities. I think Benjamin Netai, John J. Sullivan, John J. Sullivan Jr., and I believe it was and Benjamin. I forget what the last pseudonym was, but he was an operative of the intelligence agencies, the United States intelligence agencies, I should say. And Netanyahu is one of the people who had organized in in Jerusalem and in Tel Aviv, these international conferences on the danger of terror. George Shultz was there, Bush Sr., a number, I think Alexander Haig, a number of U.S. military members of the Joint Chiefs, and so on. This whole category of terror, which the Zionist state has used as its rationale for all its predations, was then absorbed and assimilated by U.S. capitalism itself. Interestingly enough, in the late 70s, a fellow named Odid Yinon, who was a Mossad figure, who published something called A Strategy for Israel in the 1980s, which laid out an agenda for demonizing all opposition as that of terrorists, and for fragmenting each Arab state in ad seriatim into its ethnic and religious components. High on that agenda was Iraq, of course, and all of the rationale for what we now have seen unfolding was articulated there. It was quickly adopted in the U.S. councils of state, notably by a lot of the Zionist institutions who pushed it, the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs, the American Enterprise Institute, of course, APEC. But, I mean, they were pushing on an open door because, I mean, their financiers, the members of the U.S. ruling class, were cheerleading this and implementing it. And the so-called neocon agenda is an agenda that is shared by both political parties and all wings of capital and has been part of that stratagem for rationalizing imperialism from the moment that they needed something to replace the former Soviet Union as the justification for their predations. 9/11, by the way, is integral to all that we're discussing here. And, of course, the Israeli state, it's interesting about that. You know, Maya and I both are of Jewish origin. My parents were Hungarian Jews. And as you're probably aware, in 1944, something like 800,000, Hungarian Jews were exterminated, and most of my relatives, and in that process, I should mention, the Zionists were active collaborators, the so-called Kastner Affair, where David Ben-Gurion sent emissaries, namely one named Kastner, to meet with Eichmann. And in exchange for support for the Zionists, they colluded in the extermination of the Hungarian Jews. This is amply documented. The former Zionist ideologue Ben Hecht, you know, the screenwriter, when this was disclosed, was so appalled, so traumatized, he wrote a book called Perfidy. But this record goes back to the origins of Zionism. If you don't mind, we could take a moment and discuss that.
Yes,
if you
sure.
want to go on to other things.
No, but when, about that.
Well, I think one has to understand that the Zionism as a political movement has its origins in the 1880s in Europe. When members of the haute bourgeoisie, the upper middle class amongst Jews, were very frightened and alarmed by the profound radicalization that was affecting the mass of Jews in Europe who were ghettoized, impoverished, marginalized people. I mean, my grandparents weren't even allowed to have a surname. They were in ghettos, they were constantly subject to pogroms, persecutions and massacres, not unlike what the Zionists are doing to the Palestinians today. And of course these people in their impoverishment and their persecution were radicalized and were joining the anarchist and socialist and communist movements of opposition to these feudal regimes and these deeply reactionary governments and so on. And these upper middle class Zionists or Jews understood very clearly that to combat anti-Semitism or scapegoating a victim population to deflect popular anger away from the authors of their misery to, you know, sort of gypsies or Jews or Slavs, or as we see in the United States, so long with done with blacks or with immigrants or of one or another ethnic origin. That's the game that's always been played. And the Zionists offered their active collaboration with the most anti-Semitic regimes of the day. The founders of political Zionism, Chaim Weizmann and Theodor Herzl, contacted Count von Plehve, who was the minister of the Tsar, responsible for the great pogroms of Kishinev, you know, the black hundreds that massacred Jews across the shtetls and ghettos of Tsarist Russia. And he said, "We will rid you of your anarcho-Bolshevik subversive Jews. You arm us and you finance us, and we will establish a beachhead in the Arab East where we will protect your commercial and and military interests and help you in displacing the Ottoman Empire there." They, and interestingly enough, they made the same approach to the Sultan of the Ottoman Empire. They approached French imperialism with the same proposition. They approached the Kaiser. They approached the British Raj. There was, as it is in South Africa at the time, amongst the European settler population, well-established commercial and middle-class Jewish population who were part of the settler movement in South Africa. They made common cause with the Zionists immediately. And this has been the pattern, because the Zionist movement, for example, they didn't stop short of Mussolini. Menachem Begin, who you mentioned before, he headed up the Zionist youth movement called Beitar. They wore the black shirts. They gave the fascist salute. They didn't miss a beat when Hitler assumed power. The Zionist Federation in Germany immediately offered its services to the Nazi regime. At the time, Jews across Europe, at the time of the rise of Hitler and all of this, wave of persecution to which European Jewry was subjected, attempted to organize a boycott of the German economy at the time, the Nazi economy, I should say, the time of the Great Depression, when marks were being carried around in wheelbarrows. You know, a million marks could get you a loaf of bread. Next week it was 2 million. So it was highly vulnerable. Well, the Zionist movement established something called the Havara, and they broke the Jewish boycott of the Nazi economy. And it wasn't just a Jewish boycott, of course. I mean, people who were anti-fascist and anti-Nazi were amply supporting this. The Zionists became the instrument for marketing Nazi goods in the Middle East and in Western Europe. Didn't stop there. Ben-Gurion and the Haganah, the Palmach of the labor Zionists, they brought Adolf Eichmann to Palestine in the 1930s. They brought Baron von Mildenstein, the head of the Waffen-SS, to Palestine, who had a publication at the time called Der Angriff, which means the assault. And he did a 12-part series praising Zionism. Goebbels actually ordered a medallion with the swastika on one side and the Zionist Star of David on the other. And as late as 1940, Vladimir Jabotinsky, who was the leader of what they called the revisionist Zionism, revisionist insofar as they were not satisfied with just Palestine. And we'll come to that in a moment. But he, in his book called The Jewish War Front, in 1940, he says, Herr Hitler has made rather popular the notion of population transfer, the euphemism, of course, for extermination. He said, now we have the moral authority to remove the Palestinian Arabs from the area that we wish to colonize. Huh? And to give you the flavor, I mentioned before the Jewish agency that was appearing before the UN in 1947 with respect to the partitioning of Palestine. The person who represented the Jewish agency there was Rabbi Fishman, who presented a map from the second volume of Theodor Herzl's two-volume diaries. I think it was page 711. And the map, interestingly enough, represented what the Zionists called Eretz Israel, the land of Israel. Well, it included all of Palestine, all of Lebanon, all of Cisjordan, two-thirds of Syria, a half of Iraq, the southern tier of Turkey, Egypt up to the Nile, including Cairo, one-third of Saudi Arabia, and Kuwait. Eretz Israel, the land of Israel, everything from the river, the brook of the Nile to
Euphrates.
Yes, exactly. Thank you for that, the Euphrates. So, I mean, the Zionist apparatus, this is their history. The irony of this all is that they have, as you are well aware, wrapped themselves in the collective shroud of the 6 million victims of the Nazi extermination amongst the Jews. Of course, Jews were hardly only the only people who were massacred in this fashion, Slavs and gypsies and homosexuals and trade unionists and intellectuals and students and teachers of every ethnic origin and religious affiliation were put in these camps and murdered or tormented. But the irony of it all is that here are these Zionists who are constantly invoking the Holocaust to create some patina of moral legitimacy for their predations and their oppressive state. They are the most active collaborators from its inception with Nazism and the most racist and repressive regimes of the past 150 years. That's the history. That's the legacy. That's the reality, and that's the ideology of this colonial settler regime. One last point about this. I mentioned, if you recall, how after the massacring of the population left in their hands this huge number of Palestinian towns and villages, of course the Zionists immediately seized all their homes, all their buildings, all their olive groves, all their orange groves, all their stone quarries, all of the productive forces of Palestinian society was seized. I mean, hundreds of millions of dollars worth, which made feasible this colonial settler state. Yeah, they made the desert bloom with Palestinian homes and buildings and livestock and industry and businesses. I mean, the flag of this operation should be a skull and crossbones. What did they do after they'd driven the population out? They immediately established laws under the Jewish National Fund's criteria, which stipulate that to be entitled to work land, to rent it, let alone to own it, you have to establish at least four generations of maternal Jewish descent. Now, suppose in this country or in any other country, in order to be entitled to live on land or work on it or sharecrop it or own it, you had to prove you had no Jewish blood for at least four generations. Who wouldn't immediately understand the quintessentially racist nature of a state of this character? The Zionist state would be an outrage even if it were anchored on a ship off of Haifa. It has nothing to do with the territorial reach. It could be a postage stamp or a continent. We don't want miserable regimes that are racist to the core, that define rights on the basis of an ethnicity or religious affiliation. That's the basis of the world opposition to apartheid South Africa, to all such theological regimes which persecute peoples who don't subscribe to whatever the official religious dogma of the particular location happens to be. This is a basic 18th century democratic idea. So the rationalizations for the Israeli state are based upon the falsification of history and on the creation of these entire myths as to the character of the state, its origins, and its behavior.
who do they hold their allegiance to? It doesn't even sound like they have any kind of allegiance to them, to anything. I mean, other than themselves, but...
Well, I mean, the Zionists, you mean the Zionist regime or the Israeli state or these politicians?
The Zionists, I guess.
Well, I mean, the Zionism is an ideology of a colonial settler regime, and their allegiance is to their paymasters, which is American capitalism, and, of course, to the state apparatus from which they benefit. That's their allegiance. If you're asking the question of whether Zionists are, I mean, it's fashionable at times to speak about the APEC and the lobby, the Zionist lobby, as the ones who actually are in command and control the American state. I mean, that's basically silly. The $10 trillion state is controlled by this little apparatus that couldn't, move without the U.S. subsidy? No. I mean, it's extremely useful to U.S. imperialism to have the Zionist state, which they constantly present as the only, quote, democratic, unquote, society in the region. They attempt to create a moral patina for imperial predations in the region by reference to the Zionist state as the refuge of the survivors of the Nazi Holocaust, right? Well, I mean, that whole process in Europe was entirely supported by Western European capitalist powers. Not, you know, the Jewish resistance like that in France or in Norway or in Holland or throughout Europe, the resistance to fascism, the Jewish resistance was pleading with various organizations, Jewish organizations, to call for the bombing of the railroad tracks leading to the extermination camps, for flying arms into the resistors to resist Nazism. And that's the last thing the Zionists were interested in doing. And on the contrary, even the attempts to create token emigration possibilities for Jews facing extermination were opposed by the Zionist apparatus everywhere.
I need to go ahead and do an identification statement.
Yes, please. Okay. I'm sorry.
Right, okay, this is KHEN LPFM Radio, 106.9 Salida, Colorado, community-supported radio, and this is Truth Quest with Melody. And my co-host tonight is Professor Eric Carlstrom, and our guest tonight is Ralph Schoenman. But support for KHEN and Truth Quest is brought to you by Kevin Barnes, agent for Land Property Inc.'s Little River Ranch, offering beautiful land home packages with underground utilities and river access just 3 miles from historic downtown Salida. Find out more at ColoradoHomeProperties.com or Kevin at 719-207-0858. Okay, you can go ahead.
Well, Ralph, if I could just jump in.
Please.
Yeah, the description you've given of the ruling elite in America and the ties, the historical ties with Zionism, very, very complete, seem to be very detailed. What I'm not hearing you talk about, which I have read many others speak about, is the relationship with England. And I hear many now talking about the Anglo-American Empire or the Anglo-American Zionist Empire, or put those words however you want, and that it's a kind of a threefold
quite frankly, I mean, this is cloud cuckoo land, because the British Raj is a toothless old lion, long displaced. I mean, it's a complete dependency of U.S. imperialism. The British Crown represents zilch, other than the millions of dollars of land ownership that the Queen has. But in terms of actual power, the British, all of British colonial and imperial domain has been usurped by U.S. imperialism, and it's a complete dependent. It bargains for crumbs off the table of U.S. capitalism, and I mean, Lyndon LaRouche and these Looney Tunes like to talk about the decisive role of the British Crown. I mean, it's just doesn't bear the faintest scrutiny of how power is structured in either the United States or in capitalist society at large, as I was attempting to elucidate a bit earlier. So no, I mean the British capitalism is ruthless enough. I mean they facilitated with the U.S. and with the Israelis their own 9/11 and the events of the London bombings. No question. I mean they have the most repressive legislation parallel to that which was adopted under Bush and sustained by Obama with respect to the elimination of basic democratic rights and for the population. All of that is I hold no brief for British capitalism, let alone this toothless, decadent royal family and all of that, which is largely a symbolic attempt to sustain the ruling class in Great Britain. But it's hardly a tripartite hegemony over the centers of capital in the world or of power. You know, I mean, right at this time, at the time of the Great Depression in the 30s, right, there was no way in which the capitalists could extricate themselves from this crisis of late capital, where the rate of profit was falling to the point where it was no longer feasible to sustain capital operations in the so-called market. Consequently, what they attempted with the pump priming of Keynes was to, through deficit financing, to sustain, much as they're attempting to do now with the handing over to the banks and the captains of capital resources with which they thought they could, quote, what, jump start the economy. In the second term of Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal, middle of the New Deal, second term, 38, there was another depression that was equal to that of 1929, when something like 17% of the workforce was unemployed, and they had no way of responding to that, and they were facing with tremendous radicalization on the part of the American working class, controlled and contained only by the advent of Joseph Stalin and his reactionary bureaucracy, which subordinated all these struggles of oppressed and working people to one or another wing of the bourgeoisie, in this case the New Deal of Franklin Roosevelt. So what did they do? They put people to work for the merchants of death. Now, the former unemployment figures became those percentages of the workforce that were engaged in military production. And the prior percentages of the workforce that had been in that prior moment engaged in military production was equivalent to what now was the figures for the unemployed. In a space of something like 40 years, over $10 trillion was handed over to the military and to the Pentagon, and capitalism became addicted to arms production like an addict needs his fix in an ever-increasing doses. Deficit financed, and increasingly what we call productive forces were being eliminated and destroyed, because what was essentially taking place in this decadent, decaying moment, this terminal decay of the capitalist order, was that all effective investment was in speculation, in paper shuffling, in debt instruments, in which they, you know, like with these mortgages that they securitize, and then they extrapolate a value from that, from which they derive something, which they then trade and speculate upon, and they hand over trillions of dollars based upon no actual collateral of any substance.
Yeah.
Well, it's a Ponzi scheme. It's a house of cards. And, of course, it's only a matter of time before the whole damn thing implodes like we've just been experiencing.
Yeah, and then they tell us that our mortgages are toxic because of all the crazy speculation they did with our mortgages.
And they, you know what they've done between Bush and Obama? They've handed over, according to Bloomberg News, the Financial Times, $11 trillion to these banker gangsters. And what do they do with this money? They literally have passed legislation under Geithner, who was formerly the head of the New York Federal Reserve under Bush, and who is the Secretary of Treasury of Mr. Obama. What they have done is to preclude any entitlement to even ask the question, how, where's this money going? Hey, you know, it's going not just into their pockets, but to buy up anything that they grab hold of at bottom prices. They're not investing it in zilch. And they're just about to replicate the same old, same old. So, hey, there's no money for housing. There's no money for health care. There's no money to renew the infrastructure of our dying cities, where one-third of which is a decaying slum. But there's trillions to hand over constantly to these banker gangsters in this dictate of capital. You know, I mean, it's, and just to put this in some kind of perspective, what is $1 trillion? It's $1,000 a minute since the birth of Jesus. I mean, they are cannibalizing the infrastructure of our societies. And you are going to see, as we are experiencing now, people are one paycheck away from being homeless. Our homes are being destroyed. Our jobs are being eradicated and eliminated. Productive forces are down the tubes. It's a speculative, derivative-based economy of these Madoffs writ large across the entire spectrum of U.S. capitalist operations. And these are the folks who are servicing any given administration. I mean, who has Mr. Obama put into place? Paul Volcker, Bernanke, who did he depend upon? There was a marvelous moment, you know, one about something like 8 or 9 days before the election, when Clinton, Bill Clinton, was appearing in Orlando, Florida on the stage with Barack Obama. And at a certain moment, Bill Clinton got this Cheshire-like grin on his face, and he said, you know, well, Barack's going to be upset with me for telling you this, but he says, you know, I want you to understand how reliable and how trustworthy this man is. He said, Barack, when this when the question of bailing out the banks occurred, he called up Paul Volcker, and he called up Alan Greenspan, he called up Warren Buffett as chief advisor, and he called me up and he says, tell me what to do and I'll sell it, quote unquote. Well, I mean, who is in control of these two political parties, which we call the one big property party with two names? It's this capitalist ruling class that was so well described by Townsend in his book Up the Organization.
So it's
the same bunch of crooks. You know, we did a 13-part series on Taking Aim about Barack Obama called False Hope and Short Change. Mm-hmm. I think everybody can see with their own eyes now what this is all about.
Well, I understand that there's a mathematician or two who have named the new world's highest number after Obama because he's given away so much money.
He is, I mean, look, I mean, Barack Obama, it's no point demonizing this particular politician. He's like all of them, they're hired hands. I mean, his career was essentially forged on Wall Street and by Archer Daniel Midland, who funded him. He was vetted and presented and paraded before Volcker, with whom he had a constant, almost daily communication on his, not just cell phone, but, BlackBerry. His BlackBerry. And it's so transparent now. Even people like Robert Reich, who was Clinton's Commerce Secretary, he wrote this piece, Obama's Wall Street Bailout. Before it can clean up Wall Street or do much anything else, the administration has to clean up the way it's trying to clean up Wall Street. You say AIG is rapidly becoming a nightmarish metaphor for the Obama administration administering the bailout of Wall Street. The central problem is the lack of any transparency. Nobody knows what they're doing. Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner knew weeks ago AIG was planning to issue bonuses to executives in its notorious credit default swap. Even if Geithner discovered this last week, he faces the obvious question, how can he claim he didn't know it sooner? But these bonuses are just the tip of the iceberg. They're latest in a series that were not even distributed till last Friday. He said the Treasury has been readying another big multi-billion-dollar payout to AIG on top of the $170 billion already provided, because AIG has been hemorrhaging red ink. The balance sheets have been deteriorating far more quickly than the Treasury had ever acknowledged. There's no exit strategy for stopping the flow of taxpayer money. He said the Wall Street bailout is essentially handing over vast, untold sums to the same people who had speculated them away. And the Obama administration assured the public that taxpayer money would no longer be used to backstop the Wall Street bonuses, but Obama is in fact doing precisely that. Much of the $170 billion, Wright continues, used by AIG to pay off putative obligations to Wall Street banks go to Goldman Sachs. Goldman has maintained it got no bailout money from the Treasury. It just took $113 billion via AIG. More troubling is that the original plan to bail out AIG was concocted at a meeting held last fall run by then-Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson, who before becoming the Treasury Secretary was what? CEO of Goldman Sachs. Also attending the meeting was Lloyd Blankenfein, current CEO of Goldman Sachs. At the meeting, Tim Geithner, then head of Bush's New York Fed. None of this would be nearly as awful if the Wall Street bailout worked, but we're 6 months after it began, and almost no loans are being made to Main Street. The Fed is launching its program to get loans to consumer finance by private investors. It's a joke. The Wall Street bailout is the most expensive, tax-supported fiasco in the history of the United States. And the problem for the Obama administration is that this bailout is now exposed for the public to see. It isn't possible for an economy to bounce back from this. And he says the president cannot afford to lose the public's confidence, because the public has only gone along with this so-called stimulus package because it's been sold the idea that there would be some kind of transparency and control. The public now sees that it's money thrown down a rat hole. And the bottom line is, before you can clean up Wall Street or anything else, you have to clean up the way you clean up Wall Street. Now, you know, that's an insider blowing the whistle, Robert Reich. But actually, the enormity of this it's been translated very clearly in the Washington Post and the Financial Times and the Wall Street Journal itself. All the major stock indexes soared as Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner laid out details of the administration's so-called public-private investment program, a euphemism for a scheme to bankroll private investment firms and guarantee them huge profits in return for buying failed home loans and securities from the banks at vastly inflated prices. And here's how it works. The masses of Wall Street who have been driving up the share prices, especially bank stocks, in anticipation of the rollout of this program, were delighted to find that not only met but exceeded all their expectations. Hedge funds and private equity firms participating in this scheme put up less than 5% of the capital to buy $1 trillion of bank junk assets, with the government providing the rest, and in low-cost loans from the Federal Reserve to the banks so they can put up even their share. So even though the bulk of the capital and financing comes from the government, the public-private investment funds set up under the scheme are run by private investment firms linked to the same banks, who receive lucrative fees for dividing up the booty. The banks cheer the deal because it allows them, at their own discretion, to palm off their bad debts at prices many multiples of what they could fetch on the market, and the government bankrolls the big investors and assumes all the risk, passing it on to the public. And investors are willing to pay inflated prices for illiquid loans and securities because they calculate they can hold the assets until the housing market recovers, sell them back to the financial markets at a return of 20% or more. The banks cleanse their balance sheets of toxic waste and lay the basis for a rise in their stocks. They cash in on that and wait for the next collapse. I mean, this goes on. This is the most shameless racketeering. I mean, these are gangsters. They're not just bankers.
Okay, and, so you're laying the blame primarily at the bankers then.
Pardon me?
You're laying this all at the bankers' feet then.
I'm writing it at the captains of capital who capture the state, who use it as their private subsidy, subsidize their own operations with it, of course.
Okay, and how America or U.S. plays in with this is being their playground to pilfer and take from at this point. But it looks like they're spreading it around the world. Correct.
Well, of course, because all of these various societies, whether they're run by a feudal family or by a corrupt bureaucracy or by bank and corporate capital, are subject to the market controlled by U.S. imperialism, and they're basically satraps of this. They're extensions, and they shelter from their own angry and exploited populations under what we call the counter-revolutionary shield of U.S. imperialism itself. This is a crisis of capitalism. This is the capitalist order in a process of terminal decay. This is the circumstance in which a tiny oligarchy, this 1% of the population that owns more than 90% of the rest of us combined, as the Wall Street Journal acknowledges, has captured the state. They subsidize the two political parties, which are the one party, big property party, with two names. Working people, the people who produce all value, get zilch. They have no health care anymore. Their pensions have gone down the tubes. Their job security is a thing of the past. You can forget about retiring, and we're only at the little beginning of this. So what are we having to, what can we do about this? Let me tell you something. I live in the Bay Area, and this is the 75th anniversary of the great general strike and great maritime strike of the International Longshore Workers Association of 1934. Now, there's a big developer named Hines Real Estate, H-I-N-E-S Real Estate Developers. They made $25 billion last year. They operate in something like 16 countries. They have hundreds of millions of square feet of property. And they came up with what we call a sneak attack scheme. They went into an area right on the Embarcadero near the famous and historic maritime and waterfront district of San Francisco. And they put in a project before the planning board and the board of supervisors with a fake address. They put it in the address as 110 Embarcadero, which doesn't exist. It's the address that they want to create with their 11-story glass high-rise. What do they want to destroy and take down? It's 113 Stewart Street, which is the location of the International Longshoremen's Hall, Local 3879 of Harry Bridges in 1934, where Bloody Thursday occurred, where 1,000 police and armed goons using shotguns and chemical weapons and gas bombs attack workers across San Francisco, shooting and killing them in streetcars, and above all at the location of the International Longshore Workers Hall at 113 Stewart Street. Here on the 75th anniversary of the Great General Strike, the most signal event in the labor history in the United States, they wanted to wipe off the map this building. So a close friend of mine named Bradley Wiedmeyer, who is an architectural historian, scoped this out. And what we did was we went and we mobilized the International Longshore Workers of Local 10, which is the legatee of Local 3879, the Marine Firemen's Union, the Sailors Union of the Pacific. We mobilized the shipping clerks. We mobilized the Walking Bosses Union, Local 91. We had organized labor now alerted to what was this sneak attack. And why is it that on the 75th anniversary, this developer, by the way, they hired the most expensive firm and lobbyists, met with every member of the Board of Supervisors, of course, all the members of the Planning Department. They created a fake historic report in which they represented that this building that they were going to remove, unnamed, had made no contribution of any significance to the history or development of the city of San Francisco, nor was anyone associated with it in any way connected to anything of importance in the development or history of the city of San Francisco. Well, we had 1 week to, they plotted this thing for years. They were going to put up a 11-story glass high-rise in this protected historic waterfront district. And, you know, what we said to the planning board, those board of supervisors, is, look, first you shoot Malcolm X, then you put his picture on a postage stamp, then you execute Martin Luther King, and you name a day after him on his birthday. Now you want to destroy the living landmark, the living building of the International Longshore Workers, where Harry Bridges organized the general strike, and you're going to put a plaque in the arboretum on the 11th floor for the seagulls to decorate. Whose history is this? Yours or ours? This is a fraud. You've been lied to. You've been faked. You've had a fake report, and you've put your stamp of approval on it. You should have some sense of decency here. Don't associate yourselves with this fraud, because when you do that, you discredit yourselves before not just the people of San Francisco, but before working people across this country. And we mobilized. And the legacy of 1934 is as follows. As soon as the longshore workers went out on strike, the bosses of the day attempted to make concessions to longshore. And the headlines of the newspapers said, as the armed goons were attacking the hall and attacking workers across San Francisco, strike over, it's all over but the shouting. What did Harry Bridges say? He said, this isn't just about longshore. This isn't only about maritime. It's about everybody who works for a living that doesn't want their head split open by goons when they ask for a living wage. He said, an injury to one is an injury to all. He says, we will never get decent jobs, union jobs, good-paying jobs that people can live on if we don't mobilize, if we don't form the great, mighty union. The legacy of 1934, which these developers attempted to wipe off the map, is precisely prologue to the future. It's the mobilization of the working class, of people who work for a living, produce everything of value, and who are being stripped of their security and their health care and their jobs and their homes. That's where change is going to originate from, not from fakers like Mr. Obama, but from the people of the United States, whose government has been stolen from them by this handful of criminals and crooks who produce from everything from 9/11 to this toxic bailout of a capitalist economy in terminal decay. That struggle is just beginning to unfold. We have a history on which to draw. We have a legacy from which to build. And it was articulated by the International Longshore Workers in 1934. We start from that point, not only here in San Francisco in the Bay Area, but across the United States.
Well, you know, Ralph, there's a lot of people that are talking about the North American Union as a kind of a stepping stone toward a global union, so-called New World Order, which might be, global governance under the United Nations, that kind of thing. Do you see that there's a possibility that this financial meltdown might be orchestrated in order to crash the dollar and force us into a union with Canada and Mexico so we have to accept the Amero in order to, you know, keep a roof over our heads, et cetera? Or do you think...
No, this is right-wing Looney Tunes stuff, I'm sorry to tell you. The New World Order is a catchphrase of Bush Sr. after the collapse of the Soviet Union, when he was stating that now there's no impediment to the market and the reach of capital across this globe. It's a New World Order that's at hand here. We no longer have a publicly owned economy to impede us in any large sector of the planet. That's the mean. It's a catchphrase, New World Order. the right wing talks about world government and the United Nations. Give me a break. What kind of, this is silly talk. This is to deflect our awareness away from the fact that it is capitalism that has control over our economy and our state apparatus. Government, per se, is our instrument for change when it's under the democratic control. We had a revolution in the 18th century to put government in the hands of the population that works for a living. That's what democracy is supposed to be about. The extension of the control of the many over the means of production, not just the formal facade. Power isn't exercised through the halls of Congress. Those are hired hands. Those are public relations folks whose parties are paid for by the captains of capital. As Tony Mazzocchi of the oil and chemical workers once put it when he was starting the Labor Party, the bosses of two parties, we need one of our own. So give me a break here about this talk about one world government and the United Nations and all of that. The United Nations, it consists of countries that have the exact same class structure as our own. The same oligarchs that are in control of those societies at the bidding of capital, who operate the same scams upon the public whose government they have usurped. Capital has been global since Marx wrote the Communist Manifesto. The modern state is just the executive committee of the capitalist class. They have deployed it as the subsidy of their own. They don't pay taxes for 10 years at a time. They milk the public and they exploit us. They pay us pennies and they take the surplus value of what we produce in the form of profit. And this talky talk about the United Nations or a union between Mexico and Canada and the United States, that's on nobody's agenda. The U.S. has hegemony over these various regimes. They're busy attempting to bring the Obama has talked about sending the military into Mexico, not to form a union, but to smash the organized working class in Mexico that is challenging this increasingly decrepit and dysfunctional capitalist and property-owning class in Mexico. Union my ass. They're not talking about union. They're talking about the kind of operations that produced Adolf Hitler in Germany and fascism in Europe. They want to replicate it wherever there is a struggle of the oppressed to shore up these corrupt latifundia and tiny little oligarchies, just as we have in the U.S., so in Mexico, so in Canada, and so everywhere else.
So if
the antidote to that is the population. We are the many. They are the few. We have
the European Union now. I mean, through a series of trade agreements that evolved over 50 years, the sovereign nations of Europe have moved in towards a larger trade entity with bureaucracies that dictate many aspects of their life. And according to books such as The Late Great USA by Jerome Corsi, there have been many meetings since 2005 between the leaders of Canada, Mexico, and the United States, whose purpose is to merge first Canada, United States, and Mexico, and then there are supposedly plans afoot to also include all the countries in South America and Central America as well.
Yeah, I mean, as I say, there isn't a scintilla of evidence for this. What you're really describing is something entirely different, namely the so-called free trade agreements like NAFTA, which has absolutely zero to do with trade. It has nothing to do with trade, either fair or otherwise. What it has to do is with privatization. What it has to do is pitting workers against each other. They destroyed something like 40 to 50% of the of working jobs in Mexico. They created these maquiladora or these free investment zones in various parts of Mexico, so Zenith can pay workers there, move over from San Diego to pay workers 69 cents an hour. So auto plants can shut down their plants in Tarrytown and open them up in Shenzhen, China, where they can pay people $40 a month, or in Ypsilanti, Michigan, they shut down the plant, they open it up in Toluca, Mexico, where they can pay people $8 for a 12-hour day. That's what this is about. It's about exploitation. It's about imposing through the International Monetary Fund the dictate of capital, pauperizing people, pitting workers against each other. That's why the auto workers in St. Paul, Minnesota, went over to Mexico City to help organize the auto workers in Mexico, not out of any kind of charity, because they know capital is international, and workers have to bond together so they can't pit us against each other and whipsaw us and play us, old against young, black against white. This is the men against women, workers in the North against workers in the South in the United States. This is the oldest game in the world, the salami tactics of pitting the exploited against each other so they cannot unite and fight against their common class enemy. It has nothing to do with the forms of governance, which have nothing but the dictate of capital to define them over whatever little piece of territory they preside over. It can be a tiny little state like these island countries in the Caribbean. It can be a continent like the United States. The land area has precious little to do with the character of the regime that governs. It has to do with who owns and who rules and whose interests. And that's the question that is the defining. It has nothing to do with the United Nations. It has nothing to do with so-called world government. World government, we would like to have a federation of democratic governments where workers control and the bosses and the capitalists are thrown into the dustbin of history where they belong and where they're going to be sent. But believe me, what you're describing here with all this talk, it goes with the talk about the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve, give me a break. Banking capital has had hegemony since the 1790s. Then you're going to talk about what? The income tax? The income tax was a reform so that the government would not merely be that funded by exploiting working people, but that actually people would be taxed according to what they earn. But of course, since they control the state apparatus, the big corporations pay no taxes for 10 years at a time. What do? They offshore all their profits. Yeah?
When you were describing the Zionists over in Europe, it sounded as though they were pitting the people against all the various groups. And I'm just wondering how close in correlation is what's going on with the people in the Gaza area and as they're being taken advantage of and and their lands being taken again. Is that going to be happening here with is there going to be a resemblance of what's going on? Are you following what I'm saying?
No, I'm not. Let me tell you what I think you're saying.
Okay.
The Zionist movement in Europe, as I mentioned to you, is a movement of the upper class amongst Jews who were alarmed by the desires and the political impulses of the mass of the population who wanted to overthrow the Tsar.
Okay.
Not to placate the Tsar, not to become his instruments, which they were when they were his victims, only this little cabal of upper bourgeois figures amongst the Jews had an interest in colluding with these forces as basically sellouts. That's the role that they played.
I understand.
Suffering Gaza is part of the process. Yes, you're absolutely right. What's going on in Gaza is an atrocity. It is the most ruthless subjugation and, in fact, attempt to exterminate the population there with American arms and American funds and American guidance and American go-ahead. The Zionists are their instrument in this. But with respect to the United States, hey, American capitalism doesn't exploit people or seek oil for blood because the Jews made them do it. Give me a break. That is cloud cuckoo land stuff ad nauseam. For one thing, Jews or Italians or Irish are everything and anything depending on their class. Huh? They can be revolutionists, they can be corrupt gangsters, and they are. They can be capitalists, and they are. Ethnic origin has absolutely nothing to do with it. It's
no, I'm not talking about ethnic so much. Whoever is taking over the Gaza area and what they're doing to those people, I foresee potentially. I see a lot of correlation as to what could be happening here soon if things keep going as they're going.
Well, Gaza is an integral part of Palestine. Gaza is part of the of Palestine that was colonized by the colonial settler movement, much as the colonial settler movement in South Africa colonized the area of the African majority, much as the colonial settler movement in southern Rhodesia, in northern Rhodesia, in Congo under Belgium, across North Africa under France, Algeria, Tunisia, Morocco. It's a process of exploitation and subjugation. There's one interesting thing I'd like to say about this question of Zionism, which is distinct from the usual predations of classical colonialism, British, French, German, Italian, Belgian, American, what have you. The Zionists were not merely interested in extracting the resources of Palestine or cheap labor from the indigenous population. The Zionist program, they called it a land without a people for a people without a land. And the logic of that is genocide, much as it was in the United States in North America, where the settlers were not interested here as the British Imperium was. The British Imperium was interested in colonizing and did colonize this area in order to obtain the resources and to exploit the labor of those who were here. But the project of the settler population in North America was to exterminate the indigenous inhabitants, which they proceeded to do not only in North America, but after Columbus, something like 100 million people were wiped off the map. 8 million people over the life of the silver mine of Potosi in Bolivia alone over a process of 150 years. So the logic of that kind of colonial operation as Zionism represents, as it did in North America and as it did in Latin America, is a logic of genocide. Unfolding now in Gaza as it has in suffering Palestine since the beginning of the Zionist movement. And once again, I emphasize Zionism and the access to the region, the military support for it, the funding of it is a function of imperialism, of capitalism. You mentioned the British. Yes, the British, when they were the colonizing instrument in Palestine, if you remember the Balfour Declaration, you know, yeah. Who was the progenitor of that? It was General Jan Smuts of the South African Boers, who in the British cabinet was the actual progenitor of the Balfour Declaration, where Palestine was to be handed over to a colonial settler movement, which they considered would be shock troops for the British Raj. That was the same rationale that the U.S. had in transferring its ownership or control of the Zionist movement from the British after World War II, when the objective of U.S. Imperialism was to displace the former colonial domain of enemy and ally alike. They pushed out the British, they pushed out the French, they pushed out the Spanish, they pushed out the Dutch, the Portuguese, the Germans, the Italians. U.S. imperialism established hegemony, and Zionism was one of its instrumentalities for achieving that bloody objective in the Arab East. And today, the suffering of the Palestinian people, and by the way, in that respect, I want to say that the Palestinian people are the world's soldiers for justice. They have been resisting their removal from their land and from history despite the unfathomable amount of weaponry and military might that's been unleashed against them. Non-stop resistance in the form of passive resistance, in the form of strikes, in the form of demonstrations, in the form of armed struggle, in the form of what they call steadfastness. Maya and I were in Palestine in May of 2007, after 25 years, we'd been banned from Israel as agents of a terrorist power. Why? Because we were organizing a mass demonstration on the first anniversary of the massacre of the Palestinians at the camps of Sabra and Shatila outside of Beirut. And on its first anniversary, we were involved in organizing a mass demonstration, and so we were imprisoned and expelled and declared instruments of terrorism. Terrorism is somebody who resists the the terrorist state apparatus of something like the Israeli state. But what I'm attempting to say here is that what they're doing in Gaza is what they have done in Gaza since 1948, in these refugee camps, in the beach camp in Balata. This is the constant attempt, but they can't do it because the Palestinian people will not leave. The Palestinian people will not succumb to Zionist predations. They remain. They resist, and their population continues to grow. And in the presence of this steadfastness of the Palestinian population, what are the Zionists going to do? They can't. Well, they can't physically eliminate them. They can only constantly wage bloody war with terrible weaponry, and the people resist, and the region is inflamed, and the Arab masses all identify with the Palestinian people as their very voice and heart and soul. And that will not only continue, but it is spreading across the world. Everybody now understands and identifies with the suffering people of Palestine. And ever more isolated is this Zionist cabal, and, by the way, their sponsors and masters in the United States. So what I foresee in the U.S. as capitalism collapses around our ears is not a Gaza of the Zionist variety. We have our Gazas in every inner city. You know, I mean, consider it. There's 60% and 70% unemployment amongst black youth. Black male youth are an endangered species in the United States. One out of three black kids, male kids, is either in prison, on parole, or in the judicial process. You think that falls from the sky? That's social policy. The criminalization of poverty. Now it is being inflicted not only on the most vulnerable amongst us, the most exploited sector of the American working class, African American, Latinos. And by the way, I get a kick out of this attempt to talk about the illicit immigration to the United States of Mexicans and Central Americans. Isn't that interesting? Where are they coming to? Places called Los Angeles, San Francisco, San Diego, Nogales, El Paso, San Antonio. What is that? That's the area amputated from Mexico by force, by American imperialism. And when these people seek a living wage, or when they're brought over here by corporations who exploit their status so they can pay them a fraction of a living wage, you want to blame the victims? Hey,
what do you foresee taking the place of if the capitalist system is collapsing? What is going to come in and take its place?
Well, of course, we're going to have a socialist revolution in the United States, the extension of democracy to control of the economy. That's what socialism is. Socialism represents working people having control over production, deciding what is in our interest. Do we want to, where is the public fund to be invested? In creating high-rise glass buildings for developers like Heinz, or in creating, we have productive capacity in the United States sufficient for all of us to enjoy free housing, free schooling, free health care as a right like the air we breathe. It's only the backwardness of our society that allows us to accept that a tiny cabal can master trillions upon trillions of dollars and cannibalize the infrastructure of our society based upon the value produced created by our labor and usurping all of that in their under their own control as backward and retrograde a system as the feudal order of the past, as the Dark Ages. And this period of great capitalism will be understood and seen for the Dark Ages that it is, compared to what we can accomplish when we, the many, have democratic control over our lives, over the economy, over the politics of society, and over governance. That's the song of the future.
And I was under the impression, though, that Obama was talking in that direction, and you're saying, no, he's not.
How do you figure that Obama is talking in that direction? What is Obama doing? Obama
I'm not saying
is talking,
he's doing
anything. Obama is attempting to do what the captains of capital always do, is to sucker people into channeling their disaffection into controllable arenas. Obama talks vaguely about change and about hope. What does that mean? He translates that into appointing all of the captains of capital, the instruments, the same people who served Bush, the same Secretary of Defense, the same Secretary of the Treasurer, the same Rahm Emanuel, who was the Master of Security for, who was an affiliate of the Zionist state itself. Barack Obama is just another paid-for politician by the same ruling class.
I don't disagree with you on that. What I'm just saying is there was other programs that tended to look like he was leaning in the socialist direction.
Well, I tell you what. Let me read you something, a very interesting article that appeared in the publication called the State Journal Register. It said, Obama doesn't talk like Bush. He just acts like him. You can't blame Dick Cheney for being annoyed at Barack Obama. Obama is closing Guantanamo. He's ordering the CIA to interrogate prisoners according to rules within the Army Field Manual, which doesn't allow torture. He's phasing out some classic Bushian phrases as enemy combatant and war on terror. But the dark prince of neoconservatism should relax. Obama's address may have promised to, quote, reject as false the choice between our safety and our ideals, but in all ways that matter, he's keeping every one of Bush's outrageous policies in place. He talks a good game, but nothing has changed. From reading your emails to inserting the right to assassinate American citizens to bailing out the corporations whose executives pay themselves bonuses, Obama's changes are nothing but toothless rhetoric. Closing Gitmo, reported the New York Times, was, quote, a move that seemed intended to symbolically separate the new administration from Bush detention policies, but in a much-anticipated court filing, Obama's Justice Department argued that President has the authority to detain suspects without criminal charges, exactly as the Bush administration asserted, and it provided a broad definition of who can be held, no different from that used by Bush. What will happen to the POW still at Gitmo? They won't be called enemy combatants. They won't be going home either. They're going to be sent to Bagram in Afghanistan. Countless victims in Gitmo 2, courtesy of Barack Obama, tortured by the U.S. military at Bagram, the U.S. air base in Afghanistan, where Bush imprisoned hundreds of people without charges, many of them murdered in the camp's notorious salt pits. Children have not been spared, quote-unquote, says Amnesty International. Bagram is being expanded, doubled in size, to accommodate hundreds of more detainees, not only from Gitmo, but from everywhere. POWs from Obama's expanded war in Afghanistan, worse than Guantanamo, conditions that are far worse. Extraordinary rendition will continue under Obama. Quote, New York Times. In little notice confirmation testimony recently, the New York Times states, Obama nominees endorsed continuing the CIA program of kidnapping prisoners and transferring to other countries without legal rights, indefinitely detaining suspects without trial, even if arrested far from any war zone. During the 2008 campaign, Obama's critics accused him of saying nothing, although beautifully. Now we've got to know him a bit. It's time to refine that assessment. He's just a weasel, an eloquent weasel, But a weasel who says the right things while doing the opposite, that's his function. That's what he's paid to do. On March 9th, Obama ordered federal agency to suspend Bush's infamous signing statements, sneaky documents issued after the signing of a bill that ordered government agencies not to enforce the very same bill he just approved in front of the cameras. Signing statements, says the American Bar Association, use one-man dictatorial rule to negate the people's will and is contrary to the rule of law and constitutional separation of powers. Yet 2 days later, literally, Obama signed a $410 billion spending bill and appended to it a signing statement claiming that he had the authority to ignore any oversight provision or any determination by Congress. Barack Obama has perfected a three-step maneuver that could never even be attempted by a politician lacking his historical skill or cool cynicism. First, denounce your presidential predecessor for a given policy. Energize the party's base by capturing their illusions. Capitalize upon your predecessor's unpopularity. Pretend to reverse the policy with a symbolic act while adopting the exact policy, knowing it's the only way to govern without the population understanding what you're up to. This week's example is Obama's grandstanding over $165 million in bonuses paid to executives of AIG, which he had already known about and approved, which received billions, if not trillions, in federal bailout money. He feigns outrage when the population is distressed. How do they justify this outrage to the taxpayers who keep the company afloat? But his Treasury Department knew about the bonuses, which amounted to 55 cents per American. They knew about it ages ago. He also knows there isn't much the government can do to claw the money back. Unlike the count limit of this column, Obama's perfidy knows no limits. He's become more dangerous to democracy and basic rights than George W. Bush because he does the same thing without people recognizing what he's up to. Unlike Bush, he has no political opposition. Cheney may nitpick, but they're all happy to see Bush's policies remaining in place. Now, that's the this is a columnist for the Universal Press Syndicate.
Well, I totally agree with what you're saying there. I just find that it's really interesting that the rhetoric that I'm hearing thrown around so much in that direction is the socialistic rhetoric of.
Well, you heard socialistic rhetoric from who?
People out there speaking of this administration.
Well, I mean, this is again what I called cloud cuckoo land. This is it's the diametric opposite. Every single piece of rhetoric has been to laud the capitalist system and to promise to sustain it. Every single appointment comes from the captains of banking and corporate capital and the very administrators and functionaries who serviced Bush and Reagan and Clinton and the whole gang. So, you know, this is socialism? Are you serious? This is like telling me that the medieval popes were emulating the Sermon on the Mount. Give me a break.
Well, all I'm just saying is this is what I'm hearing said. I didn't, you know, and so.
Well, a lot of people are comparing some of his programs to the New Deal in the sense that he has proposed putting an awful lot of money into green technologies and building a smart grid and putting Americans.
Yeah, why he uses a certain rhetoric in order to defuse, contain, and deflect the mass opposition of working people in the United States, fostering the illusion of reformism and change. And indeed, the talk about green and health care and this is sheer tokenism, because not a dime will be left over for that after they finished empowering the gangster bankers with their trillions. They will give nothing to working people. They will put it in the hands of insurance companies and stockbrokers as they go on to gut Social Security in the process. It's the same old, same old. They soft soap you to in election time, and they sell you out the day after.
I see what you're saying.
I'm sorry?
I said I see what you're saying. I understand it. I agree.
You know, if you actually look at what happens in an American election, including national elections, you have roughly about 52% of the electorate participate, but in reality, that's 52% of the registered voters. And only about 55% of the eligible electorate registers to vote. So you're really talking about something like 25% of the electorate, and you cut that between the two parties, and these fakers are getting around 12.5% of the electoral vote, and people hold their nose when they go to the ballot box. I'm not even talking about a non-presidential election year when the turnout is 29% of the registered voters, which is 14 or 15% of the eligible electorate. In short, what people are saying is, these are all crooks. They lie to you every minute, and the second they're in office, they do the same old, same old. There's nothing out there for us. It's not because folks are indifferent. It's not because folks are stupid. It's because they have too much common sense. They've lived it. They've seen it. Deep down, the cells are counting. And what people are waiting for and people are going to organize for is some form of political struggle where we call the shots, where the people who we are supporting come from us, look like us, are answerable to us, are out of our own experience, and are not financed by our class enemies. That's the issue here for American society, as it is for societies across this planet.
Well, Ralph, I'd like to really thank you for coming on our program and giving us, you know, insight into this. Do you have any closing comments or?
I want to thank you for the opportunity I know that, you know, I mean, it's been something of a monologue, and I apologize for that. But these are, I think, issues that will address, I hope, people's real lived experience. And I would like to encourage people to go to our website, which is takingaimradio.com, where you can download any of our programs of the last 8 years gratis. And we hope to hear from you. You can contact us at our website, or at our you can contact us at www.takingaim.com, and we hope to hear from you. And I thank you again for the opportunity to speak to your audience.
Okay,
thank you, Ralph, and also Melody. Thank you to you, and we'll look forward to the next one.
Thank you, Melody.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, good night.
Good night.
Good night.